AppMedic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose of education and inspiration in the healthcare field.
Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Daniela, a student at Oxford University.
And this is
the AppMedic Podcast. Enjoy!
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Danielle Ofri, an internal medicine physician in New York, editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, and the author of 6 books. We discussed how her interest in writing began, the story behind starting BLR, which is the first literary journal to emerge from a medical center, and her advice for impactful storytelling. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about literary journalism or just intrigued about sharing their stories. So, without further ado, let's have a listen. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell you briefly about our sponsor, Amboss. Created by a team of dedicated physicians from around the world, Amboss is an interactive library of over 20,000 medical topics, interlinked with a question bank holding more than 5,500 clinical case-based questions. With all the necessary resources in one place, Amboss instantly delivers up-to-date medical knowledge to students, physicians, and faculty globally. Amboss has powerful learning and clinical tools combined into one platform, making studying a breeze and life on the wards easier. With the Amboss library and question bank side by side, students can look up terms instantly when solving questions. Students and physicians around the world use Amboss material to excel in their exams and on the wards. So sign up in minutes at amboss.com. You can try Amboss risk-free with a trial today. Now, onto the episode. Hi, Dr. Ofri. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a vet. I had a dog and I loved animals. But when I got to high school, it seemed like everyone who liked science was going into medicine. And so I just sort of followed the pack. And honestly, I knew nothing about medicine. Nobody in my family was a doctor or a nurse. My parents were both teachers. But I don't know, that was where everyone was going. So I went along with the crowd. And then when I got to college, I ended up going to school in Canada with a more British-style education, which had very separate science and arts as compared to the U.S. So I was in this 100% science physiology program, and everyone there was going into science to research. You know, medicine was just for the technicians. And so I found myself at this bit of a crossroads, but then I heard about something called the MD-PhD program. And that seemed to be the perfect solution. I could do both degrees and figure out the other end. So I did an MD-PhD with a plan to go into neurology since I was doing neuroscience research. But I did my 1 year of internal medicine internship pre-neurology and really fell in love with the patient stories there and stayed in internal medicine and clinical medicine after that.
Wonderful. And what did you get your PhD in specifically?
I did biochemistry of opioid receptor signal transduction.
Wow, that's really cool. And it's really interesting because you're, of course, a celebrated writer and the author of 6 books. So it's interesting you have both that PhD experience and, of course, it's very humanistic experience as well. So I'm really curious, how did that interest in writing begin?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I got to McGill, because I was going to straight science, there was no English requirements, nothing, very dissimilar to my colleagues in America. But a graduating senior said, hey, if you don't take a course with Professor Ruth Weiss, you will have wasted your education at McGill. But, oh, that's interesting. You know, pray tell, what does Dr. Professor Weiss teach? And she taught Yiddish literature, something I'd never heard of, but it was a great recommendation. So I took it. And I completely fell in love with this genre of storytellers from Eastern Europe at the turn of the century, Isaac Basevich Singer, Shalom Aleichem. And then from there, I took a Russian literature course and then Russian history. And I kept going deeper and deeper. I mean, I always loved reading and writing, but it really fell away, you know, as I got into my professional medicine and science careers. And then when I did my training, I remember thinking during residency that I should really be writing some of this stuff down. You know, it's all intense and interesting, but, you know, who has the time? But I ended up taking off a year and a half after I completed my training, which was 10 years, you know, between the MD-PhD and the medicine residency. And I decided to do locum tenens, which is temp work for doctors. And you know, in the US, there's a huge doctor shortage outside the big cities, something I had no idea. And all these small towns were short on doctors. So I did these short-term stints to, you know, pay off my loans and my bills. But while I was there, I began writing down the stories that had been accumulating in my mind through residency. And when I got back to Bellevue, which is where I always, you know, wanted to work. Bellevue is a huge public hospital. It's the oldest public hospital in the United States. You know, I started to work on these stories, but I also asked my students to start writing some stories because I got a little tired of reading all their history and physicals because they all sound the same after the first 50 or 60. And then from there, we put together the Bellevue Literary Review, which was initially conceived as an outlet for those student writings. But in fact, we opened it up to the general public and for any kind of creative writing about health, illness, and healing. And we got 1,000 submissions in the first couple of weeks. So we knew we touched a nerve. So between those different strands, I ended up having writing and editing be a huge part of my medical career. Not what I'd expected.
Certainly. You know, I'm curious, like people often throw around the word storytelling. To you, what is the unique power of this medium, of the power of stories?
Well, as a clinician, I mean, that is the way to get the patient the medical care they need. And if I could be completely pragmatic, I mean, particular in the generalist fields like internal medicine, pediatrics, geriatrics, but honestly in any field, that is our primary data, is the patient's story. And if we don't get that correctly, we will miss the diagnosis. And I'll put a full stop there. And we can, you know, scan all the labs and the CT, MRI, which are all incredibly important. But, you know, imagine this. So we've often taken care of patients, for example, who don't have labs and x-rays, right? Many of us have practiced medicine in underserved areas that don't have those things easily. You know, it's harder, but you can do it. You know, we've all survived doing medicine during power outages when the system is down. It's a pain in the neck. You can do it. But think about when you've had to take care of a patient who's comatose, who cannot tell you their story. You can have reams of data, and we do in the ICU all the time. But we are practicing medicine with one hand and a half tied behind our backs when the patient cannot tell you what is going on, how they're feeling, all of that story. We're really practicing medicine in the dark. So we can do without technology, although we like to have it, but we really can't do much without the story. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. And I suppose, do you think there's an interplay between being able to tell stories like you've done throughout your career and with the Bellevue Literary Review, and being able to understand and extract the patient's stories? Like, what's the interplay between those two, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a bit of training those muscles, like we do with any kind of muscle. So why is poetry important? So poetry is all about metaphor, and metaphor is putting together two things that are not typically related. And that is usually reaching two different parts of your brain. And those are connections that if you don't use them, they aren't going to form. Like you go to the gym, if you haven't exercised that muscle, it just isn't going to work very well. And until you work it out, it won't become very limber. And the same with storytelling, gathering the story, understanding the character, the conflict, the plot. Those are all skills that we pull together, and they take practice like any other skill.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. You know, I want to go back to the Bellevue Literary Review. I mean, in general, in life, right, doing anything for the first time can be daunting. And as I understand it, Bellevue Literary Review was the first literary magazine to rise from a medical center. So I want to go back to sort of the story of its founding and why you thought it was important. It was clear that there was a need, as you were mentioning, with the thousands of submissions. But why did you think it was so important to start it up?
Well, you know, as we sat there with all of our students' stories that were incredibly powerful, I have to say that when the students just asked their patients to tell the story of having diabetes, having emphysema, being told of cancer, they were incredible stories, and many of them were clinically useful. They uncovered patients mixing up diagnoses. It was amazing how useful those stories were. They weren't just kind of fluff on the side. And you know, when we think about how we write about medicine, we have our H&Ps, we have our progress notes, we have the lay media with the top 10 tips for osteoporosis. But when you're sick or a family member is ill, none of that really catches the mark of what you need at that moment, right? When you are really sick, the progress note maybe it's the difference between curing and healing. And I avoid the sort of new agey term of healing, but like getting better. There's more than just getting the right antibiotic. And we all know the difference between getting the right treatment, which could be spit out by, you know, your computer or your smartphone, and having a really wise and caring doctor or nurse take care of you. Those are two very different things. And if you think about the fear of going in when you're sick or a child is ill, what it means to have a doctor who's not just smart, but is wise, which are very, very different things. And so when you think about where the vulnerability of illness, where that hits inside of us, that's very similar to the plane of where creativity comes from. And it's no accident that so many great writers, think of Virginia Woolf, you know, whose writing really comes from that source and is inspired by that. Not that you have to be sick to be a great writer, but it's unsurprising that confronting illness and mortality gives rise to such great works of art. So I think that there really is an overlap. And so as we, you know, battled and grappled with that idea, we realized that there was a hole in the societal discourse about health and illness. We got lots of great medical writing, lots of great scientific writing and lay health writing, but we weren't writing about all the other stuff, which is what I think consumes most people when they're sick.
Right. No, it's a really good point. And I think on the similar theme of doing something for the first time, you published your first book, Singular Intimacies, in 2001. I was wondering if you could tell me the story of how that came to be and why you felt it was important to put out into the ether.
So when I did my medical training, it was at the height of the AIDS epidemic, which was a lot like, you know, COVID in the spring of 2020, really intense. Patients were dying left and right. Mostly they were our own age. The deaths were very lonely, often brutal, very painful. And there wasn't a lot of ways to think about this because you were so busy. One patient died, the bed got filled, and there wasn't any time to think about what it meant to be seeing, you know, your generation just being decimated before your very eyes. And so I had been, you know, going on the same track of, you know, undergraduate, graduate degree, PhD, residency, and I never really took any time off. And so when I took this locum tenens, that was this chance to have a chance to give a little bit of time and space to these very intense and very singular stories and really start to write them down, not with any sense of publishing them, or not even any sense of, you know, quote unquote closure, but a place to put them. Because if every intense experience is wide open in your soul, it's really hard to function. You have to tuck it somewhere where it feels like it's, you know, not ignored, but not papered over either, and not a gaping wound. And so writing was that experience of giving some time and space, you know, given that most of the experiences happened so quickly and so intensely, this was the time to think about them. And so I began writing these stories down. I was in these small towns in the middle of nowhere in the US. It wasn't a lot to do coming from New York City. So it was a lot of time to write. And in between my gigs, I traveled mainly in South America, Central America, where many of my patients were from. I wanted to learn the language. And so I did a lot of writing then. And then when I came back to work at Bellevue, there happened to be an economic crisis and a hiring freeze. And when I finally got a position, they only had a 60% position available. I never considered working part-time, but that's what they had. I had loans, so I took it. And so I began writing on those days off. And then I picked up a writing brochure off the street in one of those yellow plastic, you know, bins on the street on Second Avenue and took a writing class. And that's as I began to sort of work on them and send them out to literary magazines, and eventually, you know, collected them into my first collection of essays, Singular Intimacies, which all my friends thought was about French lingerie, but it was really about the singularly intimate relationship between doctors and patients.
That's really funny. Just the story of your writing, it reminds me of a quote that I'm sure you're well familiar with already, but from the French practitioner René Lariche. Right. And he speaks about surgeons, but I think it's broadly relevant, right? Every surgeon carries within himself a small cemetery where from time to time he goes to pray, a place of bitterness and regret where he must look for an explanation for his failures. And I think it's interesting to see some parallels, not exactly, right, between the sort of the notion of the gaping wounds that require some
process. In fact, I use that quote in my last book on medical error quite specifically, because we all carry the mistakes we've made with us, you know, and some are incredibly tragic and we never let them go. They don't ever disappear. And we all carry our private cemetery of our errors or our shortcomings, you know, our misgivings, our fallings. And we, you know, it's almost like these prayer stones or prayer beads that you just keep rubbing and rubbing, trying to, you know, work on that contour. And you know, listen, there's thousands of blood pressure checks I've done in my life. I can't remember any of them, right? They're all the same. But we never forget those intense moments when you told the patient a tragic diagnosis, you accompanied someone through death, you made a mistake that harmed a patient, you helped save a patient. That happens, you know, occasionally in our careers. I mean, all of these moments, or you couldn't figure out what to do for a patient, which happens a lot. And all of those things become part of our rosary or part of our private cemetery. And writing is but one way to grapple with them. It's not the only way. But certainly what I like about writing is you also get to revise. And you can't revise in real life. You are stuck. The tape only plays once. You can't go back and fix the mistakes, prevent the pulmonary embolus. You know, that is done. But in writing, you can go back and revise. And that's, you know, something that's new to us, as I think, as clinicians, to look back, not to revise and lie about the story, but to revise in how we interpret the story, what our frame of reference is, where we put the camera lens, how close or how far back we pull it.
Before we get back to the episode, a brief word from our sponsors.
AMBOSS is a medical knowledge platform built on three fundamental elements. At the core, a comprehensive medical library helps students learn the facts and the nuances of medicine. Also central is the QBank. By using these tools, students unlock the third element, personalized analytics, which helps students make smart studying decisions. Three essential tools of learning, all in one place. It's no surprise AMBOSS has become one of the most popular resources for students and schools worldwide. Ready to take a closer look? Sign up for a free trial today at AMBOSS.com.
Now, back to the episode. You know, you mentioned in your recent book, you've been the editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review for over two decades now. You've similarly been writing books for a little bit over two decades now as well. So I'm really curious that across this time span, right, writing is not always glamorous, nor is it easy. So what have been some of the biggest challenges you faced, either building the literary review up or with your books in general? And what lessons have they gifted you?
Well, so big questions and separate questions. So for the literary magazine, you know, building up something that didn't exist before, during the pandemic, we lost our university home. So we had to become our own independent nonprofit. So that was a huge job. And I will say in the middle of the pandemic when, you know, my day job was a little busy at the time, but, you know, thanks to many supporters and helpers, we formed our own nonprofit and that's been great. It's a ton of work to run a nonprofit. I didn't expect to be doing that in addition to the rest of my career, but it's been really wonderful. I mean, you have to fundraise and write grants and keep working, but it's so amazing to watch something grow and that people, you know, are interested in this because it does have a meaning for people. So that's very gratifying. And also watching writers launch their careers in your pages and seeing people go on from unknown writers to writers, you know, with a career. In terms of my own writing, so I'd say my first book or first few books, I really reached back into the past to write. By the time I wrote about many of these instances, they'd happened 10 years ago or some long time ago. I wasn't in touch. Many of these patients either disappeared, some had passed away, some were not even trackable because I didn't even know their full name at the time I was writing about it, you know, all those years later, because I didn't keep notes that I should have. And that was different from writing in real time when I'm with my patients and really, you know, being careful about the impulse to not exploit your patients for their stories or see them as, you know, part of your writing career. So I keep a really powerful church and state separation between my writing and my clinical work, that they really are separate. And so if I do think about writing a patient in real time, I will either get their consent in real time, something I didn't do in the beginning because it wasn't feasible, or consider changing the character such that it's not identifiable. So different sorts of concerns. And then at some point, you've written all the most intense experiences of your life. You can't keep fishing from that well. You have to sort of think forward. So my earlier books are more memoir-ish, really writing these intense stories. Once I'd sort of gotten that well of stories out, then I was writing more about topics. So what patients say, what doctors feel is about emotions, and what patients say, what doctors hear is about communication. And then when we do harms, about medical error. I mean, I still pull in stories, but I also interview other people on their stories and focus it more on a topic.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. I do want to ask you, you're a contributor to The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and a number of other magazines. Some of your books have been these collection of essays and stories. Is there a particular story or essay that you're particularly proud of having shared, or you think is particularly impactful, that you could share with us?
You know, for my first book, I opened the collection with the story of a woman who I called Adrienne Barrineau, who we were about to intubate. So she gets admitted, you know, she's gasping for breath. She has had lung cancer in the past. Her x-ray may be cancer. It may be an infection. We can't tell. And she says to us, you know what? I'm only going to give you 7 days, right? If I don't get better in 7 days, take it out. Now, of course, we don't know what's going on in her lungs. If it's an infection, yes, 7 days, you know, we could probably treat a pneumonia. But if it's cancer, it's not going to get better in 7 days. And she insisted that we, in 7 days, you take it out no matter what. And so being faced with this moment, she's dictating what to give away her possessions. I'm scribbling this down on a piece of progress note paper. And then as she gets intubated, I realize that if this is cancer, those will be the last words she's ever spoken, and that we will have to hold her story and her words to our final days, you know, and the idea of holding a patient's story. And this all happened over the course of just a few hours, a very intense moment. So when I got home, I was really ripped to shreds because, you know, sometimes you're not prepared to hit the depths. You don't know what the day will bring to you. You just walk into the next admission. Suddenly someone's saying, you know what, I'm giving you 7 days, life or death on this. And you're into the real depths. And so I didn't know how I was going to make it to the next day because, you know, I can't just take a week off and recover from that. I got to go into the ICU the next day. And I remember thinking there's lots of things I could have done, right? I could have had a drink. I could have gone to the gym. I could have eaten a gallon of ice cream. I could have bawled. I could have screamed. I could have kicked the dog, you know. But instead, I wrote a letter to a friend. I wrote an email, like the kind of like, you just won't believe what happened today, and wrote this whole email and sent it out to her. And I didn't get a response, but it was enough to have told the story. And of course, I didn't realize it was a story at the time. It was just that day in the ICU. But the telling of the story is so important. And you know, I often bring up the Chekhov story, Misery, one of my favorites. And the epigraph is, "To whom shall I tell my grief?" And Chekhov, who of course was a physician in addition to being a writer, writes a story of Iona, the sledge driver, the taxi driver, who's driving a horse-drawn sleigh in the snows of Siberia in the middle of holiday season. He's doing the night shift, and with every customer, he tries to start a conversation, to tell a story, because his young son has died that week of diphtheria or what have you. And no one takes up his conversational gambit. They're all laughing, they're drunk, they're drinking vodka, they're going to a party, and the whole night goes by and no one will hear his story. He finishes the shift, he goes to the parking lot in the barn, he parks his sledge, he brings the horse in, takes off the bridle, and he starts to brush the horse, and he tells the story to the horse. The horse listens patiently, respectfully. Of course, the horse can't answer back, but it is enough to have told the story. And so the idea of telling the story, which is different from publishing the story, different from putting it on social media, telling the story, even without a response, even without an audience, can often be the most important thing. And for me, that's how I started my first book, with the idea of the need, the desire, the compulsion to tell the story.
Wow. I mean, going back to your most recent book on medical errors, it's an incredibly important policy conversation, and you offer frameworks for change and how should we get around this medical error, which is this enormous killer in the US. I believe it's the third largest killer. You know, there's a quote that I really like. It goes something like, science without policy is a few publications and nothing more. Policy without science is frankly dangerous. I mean, it's the idea that policy always needs to go hand in hand with this kind of scholarship. So I'm really curious that, how do you think about your stories and the words you put on the page? And is there some way or some framework that you use to expand beyond those words on the page, whether policy related or not?
Well, I feel like that there's a third element. There's policy, there's science, then there are the human beings that are part of it. Because even if you just take the statistic that you rattled off, medical error being the third leading cause of death, well, if you dig down to that paper really deeply, there's lots of methodological flaws and statistical issues that perhaps it's not actually that, although the news media picked up this great third leading cause of death. But you're right, there's lots of detail and depth. But is the public necessarily going to be interested in digging through a BMJ paper to the, you know, the methodological section, see how accurate that is? And frankly, will policymakers? Probably not. But if you open their eyes and maybe their soul with a compelling story, you can bring them to that. So for example, for that book, I could not start the book until I found the story to form the backbone of this. And so even though all the topics existed and I'm interested individually in procedural error and diagnostic error, I couldn't write them, any of them, until I found the story. And I hunted and hunted till I found the story of Jay, who I interviewed, you know, his wife. And, you know, it took months and months and months, the better part of a year, to pull together this incredibly complicated story. But once I had that backbone of a story, then I could think about tagging on the policy, because all different elements of his story related to policy. But policy is just numbers on a page without the human beings and their stories to make it feel like something, to make it resonate. And so that's where I feel like there's lots of people who do policy way better than me and will do the science better than me. I'm not making claim to being doing any of those. Where I feel like my niche can be is, can I pull a story together to bring elements of the policy and science to feel three-dimensional enough for both a general and a medical audience.
What a wonderful way to put it. I mean, as you've noted previously, that medicine is storytelling, right? Stories are what each patient brings to their physician, right? And as you've noted, that stories are also what physicians and other scientists can use in public education, in their advocacy efforts. So as you know, our audience is primarily that of pre-medical students and medical students. So I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to them on impactful storytelling?
Well, one thing is to pay attention to what's happening around you. You know, our teachers are more than just our professors. I mean, the teachers will be the nurses, the clerical workers, you know, the people who are taking the papers back and forth in the labs, and all these, you know, non-traditional teachers have much to tell you, and they all have stories too. So remember to look for stories in all kinds of places and to keep your ears open for detail. And that's, you know, Abraham Verghese once wrote a lovely paper for the Annals of Internal Medicine on what physicians can learn from novelists. And that is the eye for detail, the way a great author, take Ian McEwan, describes a character in the way they walk and talk and smell and their manner of being. That makes us good diagnosticians. That, you know, distinguishes the pretty good doctor from the great doctor, the smart doctor from the wise doctor. So honing those skills and just listen and pay attention. It's all there. You know, it's so easy to get caught in our, you know, mobile devices and things that catch our eyes with, you know, really quick eye candy, which is great sometimes, but then you miss the story on the subway, on the street. There are stories everywhere. You just have to open your eyes and your ears, put down your other stuff, and keep your mind open for the stories around you.
Wonderful. Well, what a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Ofri, for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.